Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothie McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Well, thank you very much. As it is so often possible to say at Intelligence Squared events, I think this is probably the coolest evening in London tonight. We are, exactly. We are very, very lucky to be here with these two folks who I'm going to introduce in a second. Making the complicated simple is something that I have a great personal interest in. In my medical school final, in the oral part of it, the most terrifying part because there's a patient sitting next to you and because you might fail and not be a doctor, the final question they asked me is, what is a hiccup? And I was reminded of this because on Saturday at the Bath Children's Literature Festival, I agreed to take some questions, and a six-year-old girl asked me, what is a hiccup? And I'll tell you what I told her, which is that I didn't know then and I don't know now. And that is one of the simplest things we can encounter. It is a simple repetitive circuit in our brains. It seems to be something to do with our evolution from tadpoles. That's the best answer we've got. We are nevertheless committed to letting you leave with new, real knowledge, and these guys are going to do the heavy lifting for me. We are now living at a moment of extreme specialization. I often think of taking a time machine back 500 years ago, and it would have been possible to meet people who did know just about all there was to be known. Although, if I had gone back, I would not know anything about the world 500 years ago. But now, it would be very hard to find, probably impossible to find, an individual who could even explain in detail the complete workings of the smartphones we almost all carry. And even if there was an engineer at Apple or at Samsung who could explain both how the microchip worked and how the screen worked, it is unlikely that same person could describe the effects of that phone on our brains, or indeed the effects of mining coltan in Congo on the Congolese people. So the range of knowledge that now exists in the world is very vast. And so we're extremely lucky to have two of the best people in the world to help us understand how we might acquire that knowledge, the range of knowledge, and who have been so amazing at popularizing it. Randall Munroe, to my right, is the creator of webcomic XKCD. And if you don't know, I would imagine everyone in the room knows it. If you don't know it, it is just a complete delight. It is as though Stephen Hawking has written Calvin and Hobbes. It is an absolute treat. He is a former NASA roboticist, which he insists is not as glamorous as it sounds, although he did work on real robots, not just the coffee machine. I would say that he has persuaded more people than any other human on Earth to play chess on roller coasters. So that record is up for grabs if you're interested. He invented geohashing, a sport driven by its pointlessness. Incredibly beautiful comics like Click and Drag in Time, in which you can kind of interact. And importantly for this evening, he's the author of What If and Thing Explainer, which will be on sale in the lobby afterwards, and which are fabulous. And he's going to talk a bit more about Thing Explainer. On my left is Marcus de Sotoy. He is familiar with XKCD and indeed references some of those comics in one of his latest books. He is a fellow of New College, Oxford, was a fellow of All Souls College, Oxford, and New College, Oxford, and I believe is aiming to complete the set before he retires. He is the Simone Professor of the Public Understanding of Science, only the second person to have held that chair. Extraordinarily, he is also, at the same time, a professor of mathematics at Oxford and does real maths with real graduate students, which is, to my mind, extraordinary. He's presented, of course, as you will all know, many television and radio programs, including The Story of Maths. And his most recent book is How to Count to Infinity. So my interest, I suppose, in science and communicating science and the way that science interacts with our lives is driven by the fact that I'm an identical twin. And I've always been interested in the role in which genetic plays in my life and my destiny. But I was wondering from each of you, if I can start with you, Randall, where did your interest in science and in communicating science begin?
Well, when you mentioned that you were wondering about this, I started thinking back to the things that had puzzled me the most as a kid. And one of the first things I remember is when I had to sit somewhere quietly for a long time, I think my father would give me one of his like business pens to play with, just so I could unscrew it, take it apart, put it back together, just something to occupy the time. And there's the little mechanism in it that you press the thumb and it clicks and the pen comes out, but then you press it again the same way and the pen comes back in. And that part of the mechanism I couldn't take apart. So I had to just guess how it worked. And then when it came time to write Thing Explainer, I was like, I'm going to draw a diagram of how that thing works. And I think it might be the hardest thing to explain in the whole book. It's a really simple little mechanism, but it's like, it works. Why does it work? It works because it's shaped like that. Why is it shaped like that? Well, that's what works for that. Like, there's no way to simplify it any further. It's just the thing shaped like that. And so I feel like that's almost been the most challenging thing in there, and still one of the hardest things to explain.
I could usually get the pen apart and then not reassemble it, to my father's irritation. Yeah. Oh, that's lovely. Marcus, how about you?
Well, it was a teacher who pulled me out of the class when I was about 12 or 13, a maths teacher. He took me around the back of the maths block. I thought, oh, I'm really in trouble now. But then he said, this used to be where he smoked his break time cigar. And he said, I think you should find out what maths is really about, because it's not what we're doing in the classroom. And he recommended a few books to me, which were kind of like, he gave me this key to this secret garden, which I still don't understand even today why we don't show everyone this amazing garden. So, and one book in particular, it was called A Mathematician's Apology by a Cambridge mathematician called G.H. Hardy. And it was about being a mathematician, and he describes it in such a creative way that it's like a creative artist rather than a kind of useful scientist. And that really appealed to me at the time because I was learning the trumpet and I was enjoying kind of creative arts. And I felt that at that point that maths was this nice bridge between being creative but still being the language of science. There was one proof in there which really just blew my mind, which was he showed with just a finite amount of argument why you can show that prime numbers, these indivisible numbers, that they go on forever. And it didn't show you how to find them. We still don't know. It's our biggest unsolved problem is trying to find where these primes are. But with just a small little bit of argument, which only depends on primary school mathematics, basically, you're able to conceive of the infinite. And that just blew my mind. And that's when I realized, yeah, I want to come up with stories like that.
So, Randall, can you talk? You mentioned that page with the pen. It's got a pen and a pencil, and you talk about the origins of ink, and you talk about the mechanism and the kinds of wood that are in a pencil, and you do it all in language that is very extraordinary for a reason that I guess I'll let you explain. But can you talk us through the Thing Explainer and what it is?
Sure. I realize I've spent a lot of my life worrying about sounding like I don't know what I'm talking about, and I think this is probably a familiar experience to anyone who's been in any kind of an academic organization, for starters. Especially, if you worry that you don't really belong. Something that one of the ways it manifests is by being really picky about language. So when you learn a complicated word for something that is a little bit more specific than a simple word, it's really easy to start jumping in to correct people when they use the simpler word. And part of that is because you say, well, actually, you're talking about this more complicated thing. But I think part of it is that that comes from just wanting to show that I know things. So, like, if, for example, when I was a kid, I learned the Earth is a sphere. It's round. And then later I learned the phrase oblate spheroid, which is the slightly more complicated word for the shape of the Earth, which is, it's not quite a sphere, it's a little squashed in the middle because it's spinning, and so it's flinging itself outward. And then that would drive me to jump in and correct people when I heard them say sphere. Well, actually, the Earth is an oblate spheroid. When doing a physics degree, anytime I hang out with a bunch of people where I'm worried I'm not as smart as them, I realize it made me do that more often, which sort of has the unfortunate side effect of making them then feel like, oh no, he doesn't think I'm smart, I'd better jump in and correct him next chance I get. And then we get this vicious cycle going of people correcting each other on things, whether or not it has anything to do with, whether the distinctions are important. I started on this project to illustrate stuff using only simple words. At first, I was just doing it because I liked coming up with dumb names for things. So I started drawing these diagrams of complicated things, and I started with trying to illustrate the Saturn V rocket. I decided to try to label it using only really common words. And so I got a list of the 1,000 most common words that I assembled. And so I couldn't say NASA, Saturn, rocket, spacecraft, launch vehicle, whatever. Instead of the Saturn V, the Upgoer V. And instead of NASA, I said it was built by the U.S. space team. And then I went through trying to label all the different parts, and what I found was it was fun to come up with kind of dumb names for things like, instead of the command module, it's like, well, this is the people box, this is where the people sit. And then instead of the launch abort and launch escape system, it was this is the thing to lift the people away really fast if there's a problem and everything is on fire, and they decide not to go to space. And then at the bottom of the rocket, I labeled it, lots of fire comes out of this end. Instead of, exhaust nacelles and so forth. And then I had a note that said, this end should be pointed toward the ground if you want to go to space. And if it starts pointing towards space, then you're having a bad problem and you will not go to space today. And I had fun with these labels, but what I really found was that I started trying to label all of the different tanks of fuel. And I was like, well, here's the oxygen tank. Okay, well, I can't say oxygen. What about here's the air tank? But this is full of air, but it's not the kind of air. It's the kind of air that you breathe, very cold, but just the part of it that you need to breathe, not the other stuff that's in the air. And then for the helium tank, I was like, well, these are full of the kind of air that makes your voice sound funny. And then there's a tank of what's basically kerosene. And I said, okay, well, this is the stuff that they used to burn in lights to make light before we had power, and so on. And it was really fun trying to figure out what's an oblique way to describe this without using the name for it. And then I went through a bunch of other kind of simple diagrams. And if you want to just sort of flip through briefly, so I did the periodic table, trying to describe every element in some simple way without using the name of the element, except for gold, which that did make my list, so I got to just call gold, gold, and all the other ones I couldn't use their names. And then I did a few other diagrams of, we can do the next, you know, of how the internal organs are connected, which I called the bags of stuff inside you. And the, you know, boxes that make clothes smell better, like dryers and so on. And then the human cell, which I think was maybe the most challenging, other than maybe that pen click mechanism. So these are the tiny bags of water that you're made of. And then lastly, I did the tree of life, where I got to then go back to just giving silly names to things, where I got to describe all these silly animals, like I called porcupines pointy cats. So I got to, you know, run through different labels. This is the last illustration in the book, if you want to put it there. And then I think my favorite name that I gave to anything was I called bats. I called them skin birds, which I like because it's wrong in sort of every specific way. Like, it's bats are not birds, and birds also have skin, so this doesn't even distinguish them from birds. But I feel like it still captures the essence of what a bat is. But what was really, really, really sort of surprising about this exercise was that, like, for anyone who's done physics, you'll appreciate, I had the word weight on my list, but I didn't have the word mass. And that is, like, the number one thing that I learned to be pedantic about. And I had to let go of it. I just had to call them all weight. And every time I did it, I could hear in the back of my head all my fellow students saying, well, actually, you know. And I had to say, well, too bad, I'm calling it all weight here, and they have to understand, you know, people will just understand I'm not using exactly the specific word here. But most of the time, it turned out it didn't matter. And when it did, I could explain why it mattered. And that was a really freeing experience, because I've struggled with that, you know, and I didn't realize how much of that came from insecurity of, but if I say this, someone might think I don't know this. I'd better say the complicated thing just to clarify that, even when it really didn't need clarifying. And so I think that was, that for me, the big lesson was how much of my sort of need to make things complicated came out of just trying to prove myself, and how letting go of that made me correct other people less, made them feel less insecure, made them feel like they needed to correct me less and make me feel less insecure. And then we both just got to share the things that we know in the terms that were easiest to explain them, you know, whether that's simple or complicated words. And that was a really good lesson. And in the process, I got to give a whole bunch of animals really dumb names. And I hope you enjoy browsing through that.
Oh, that's a lovely explanation of the book. It's particularly horrifying reading it as a doctor, because when you go to medical school, one of the few achievements, my first ever boss described, he turned to me at the end of my first job and he said, this is a first class job for a second class brain, Alex. And sorry if there are any doctors in the audience, but you learn enough words at medical school that is the equivalent of learning a new language, and then we deploy these words at patients in ways that seem virtually destined to confuse them. I don't know if there's anyone in the audience who's received a diagnosis of palmar rubra erythema, but when you explain that to patients in clinic, you usually end with the explanation that is simply the Greek for red hands. And it doesn't explain anything. We don't know why it happens. So gynecomastia is the other one. It just means breast like a woman. But if you put it in Greek, it's a bit more dignified. So I think medicine is designed... I mean, medicine's a monopoly. It's designed in some way to hold on to a body of knowledge and to extract money from someone by using that knowledge that no one else is sort of allowed to have or allowed to use. But Marcus, I just wonder, I mean, I know you know Randall's work. What do you make of this attempt to do everything, even cell biology to the space program, in 1,000 words?
Well, I think it sends out a really important message, which all of this complicated stuff, you know, if you open a mathematical journal, it just looks impenetrable. But actually behind it is always some reduction. All of these complicated formulas were once something that was something simpler, expressed in words, which were then expressed in even simpler things. So I think it actually highlights that all of science basically is built like a pyramid, and at its base, are the simple things that we understand around us. But I must say that one of the insights I had when I was doing my doctorate, I had this very complicated structure, and I was describing it in the words that I knew. And it was just, it came out as kind of as funny as your kind of descriptions of things, because I just kept on having to write, it's this which has this property, blah, 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 blah. And my PhD supervisor said, give it a name. And it was amazingly empowering, the ability to name something. I gave it a name, and then suddenly things simplified in that way. So when you're actually creating new science, that ability to name a new structure is almost the fact that you've seen something new, that it needs a name. I mean, why, you know, black and white, suddenly we see, it was like seeing the world in colour, and I needed a name to distinguish it from something which didn't have these properties. So I think what Randall's done is really fascinating, because it shows even a very complicated mathematical paper, ultimately, you can do what Randall has done with that. Fermat's last theorem, the proof of Fermat's last, you could write in just... Well, you didn't allow yourself 1,000, did you? So it was like 1,000, I think.
Right, right. Well, yeah. The word 1,000 didn't make the cut.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have to say, this is the 1,000 most common words.
But I think that's a very interesting example, the way numbers work, because, you know, the Romans, the Egyptians, they invented new symbols for each new number, so the hieroglyphics. And it was the Babylonians who had this... well, actually, we don't need new symbols all the time, because we can use these small number of symbols to just do any number as large as we want. And so that moment when you realise, actually, I don't need all of this complicated stuff. I can do it just as we do now, do the numbers from 0 to 9. I can count to infinity with the symbols from 0 to 9. So whilst the Egyptians would have had to have come up with yet another complicated new name for the next thing with another 0 on.
Well, I know that they've named an asteroid after you, Randall. Did you, when you were choosing names, did you name them after people you admired or after yourself? Or you?
Well, actually, this was a very boring sort of name, but I did a project where I actually discovered my greatest achievement, as far as I'm concerned, is what I want on my gravestone, is the discovery of some new symmetrical objects in hyperspace, which connect to some really weird bit of mathematics called elliptic curves. But I actually created infinitely many of these, and I thought, they're not really useful for anything. So I thought, well, let's make them useful. So I started a charity project. I support an educational charity in Guatemala, which gets kids off the street and into education, empowers them, their family gets healthcare, housing, if they stay in education. So I offered these groups, just like asteroids, you can name asteroids. I said, okay, you can name these symmetrical objects if you donate to my charity. And so I've sold a lot of these groups, and the charity is, you know, all of these kids in Guatemala are in education thanks to the naming of these kind of things, which symmetrical objects, which you can't physically see.
They presumably only exist in the minds of a small number of elite mathematicians.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but you can force yourself into that professor's brain if you spend enough money in Guatemala.
Well, the wonderful thing about an asteroid, you see, my thing as opposed to an asteroid, your asteroid is going to crash into something, disintegrate, decay, it won't be there in like millions of years. My mathematical object would be there forever, because mathematics, once you create it, is immortal. So,
for sheer hubris, you probably win. unless Randall's one hits Earth, and then...
Oh, well, then there won't be anybody.
Then he wins, really, yeah. I suppose, in some way.
The first thing I looked up when I learned, because it turns out there's... Not to underplay the significance of that, but it turns out there are a lot of asteroids.
Don't worry, I've got infinitely many symmetrical objects.
Right. The thing is, as your size threshold gets smaller and smaller, you really do have a virtually infinite number of asteroids to name. So, like... sooner or later, that's going to exceed the number of people in the world. But the first thing I did was they said, here, you know, for some reason, this, I think it was like my mom texted me. I was like, apparently they've named this asteroid after you. So my first thing I did was look up what its diameter was, and then how much damage it would do if we redirected it toward Earth. And the good news, I think, is that it would be large enough to cause a serious mass extinction or something. And I don't know why.
It's like a real asteroid. That's a deep impact kind of an asteroid.
Yeah, yeah. But
you're not just going to be a shooting star. But
I was really hoping. But it turns out they really don't collide very often. It's probably going to be out there until at least the sun goes nova. So that's sort of disappointing. Unless someone launches an operation to you know, use a tether or some rockets to change its orbit. And I'm not saying you should do this, but...
We'd look to you. So look, we've got a couple of challenges for both of you. Can I start with you, Randall?
Sure.
Randall has 3 2-minute challenges. You have to explain in 2 minutes each, and I think we'll just let you do them. We might pause for applause, depending on how well you do, but we'll basically let you do them, and then we'll see what we think at the end. Your challenges are a jet engine, the Mars rover, and a nuclear power station. 2 minutes each.
Okay, well, so jet engines are really strange. The simplest kind of fire-based rocket you can have is you just burn oxygen and fuel, and it shoots out the back, and that's a rocket. Then jet engines have the idea of using the air that's coming in and compressing it with a fan into a chamber, setting it on fire with some fuel, and having it shoot out the back. And as it shoots out the back, it spins some fan blades, some turbines, which is what spins the fan in the front to pull more air in. When you're going fast enough, the air is coming in pretty fast already, which helps. And that is how a turbojet engine works, which is what a lot of the older jets and some older private jets use. And the reason it's not like pulling yourself up by your shoes to have the fuel spin a propeller, which spins the propeller in the front that pulls in more fuel, which seems a little bit like cheating. The reason that works is that you can that when you're burning the fuel, it superheats it and shoots it out the back faster than it came in. And so then you can use that as it's going out, use some of its energy to spin, the propeller, the thing in the back, which is just a small portion of the energy coming out, which spins the one in the front to bring in more. So that's what's inside a turbojet. A turbofan engine is a weird counterintuitive add-on to this, which is you've got this engine here, which pulls air in, heats it up, shoots it out the back, and uses that to spin a turbine, that keeps the whole thing running. That also, what you do for a turbofan is you have it also power a larger fan in the front that not only pulls the air through, but also acts like a normal propeller. And that's the key to a turbofan engine, is it also blows air past around the whole thing, and that propels the plane just like a normal propeller. But it turns out, just if you build this, that works more efficiently. And that's why that's what we use to power all of our airplanes.
Wow. Okay, so, that was exactly 2 minutes. That was extraordinary.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. Okay. But he's got two to go.
So the next one was the Mars rover?
Mars rover,
yeah. So it turns out, we have different kinds of rocks. Some of them are radioactive, which means they just randomly decay into and give off energy. And this happens just steadily. If you make a bunch of plutonium over the course of 100 years, it will slowly decay, releasing energy. And the amount of energy it releases is tremendous. If you get it to release it all at once, it's enough to destroy a city. But if you just leave it sitting there, these particular isotopes, forms of plutonium, it'll just steadily decay over that time, releasing a huge amount of heat. When we need to send a rover to Mars, you can power it by solar panels, but they get covered in dust, and they only produce so much power, and that's not enough to keep a really large rover running for a long period of time. So what we do is we take a chunk of this plutonium. There's no nuclear reactor or anything. It's just a hot, really hot, because it's decaying all the time, and then, ideally using gloves probably, you put it in a box. Don't actually do this until you've checked with the local authorities. But then that box takes the heat and converts that through an electrical process, and it converts that into electricity, and it produces... There are about several thousand watts of heat produced, which it converts into like a couple hundred watts of electricity, and then that powers a whole bunch of different random instruments that they've bolted onto this rover, kind of randomly, and it then uses that power to roll itself around, run the instruments, look at things, and shoot lasers at the ground and see what happens.
Wow. So you could almost build a Mars rover at the end of that if you had permission.
You will hear from a bunch of international criminal authorities if you try to stockpile plutonium.
At least Westminster Council. Okay, lovely. Third one, nuclear power station.
Nuclear power station. So the big difference between the Mars rover and the nuclear power station is, so there's there are types of uranium where it decays and gives off these little particles. And most of the time, but it does it very slowly. So these are rocks, you know, metal that's not even warm to the touch usually. But, and it'll decay over billions of years. But there are a few forms of it where it has a really unusual property, which is the stuff that it gives off, if it hits more of itself, it triggers that decay instead of having to wait for it to happen spontaneously. Now, usually you don't have enough of it in one place. If you have a small amount of it, it'll just, all the little neutrons and stuff that it's giving off will shoot out of it and hit people and, you know, cause health problems. But if you bring more of it together, it will trigger more of those neutrons to be released, which then triggers more decay, and if you bring too much together, you get the nuclear bomb that destroys the city. But if you bring it just close enough together that you get, you can get it to elevate the rate at which these decays are happening and the energy being given off without destroying a city. And then you do that very carefully, controlling that reaction, and then you just use it to run an ordinary steam engine, effectively. You use it to heat up water, and the water turns a turbine, and then that generates electricity. You do have to be careful, though. You need the water to carry away this heat, and it produces so much heat that actually becomes a problem. So you have to sit it next to a gigantic body of water so you can keep pumping water in, and that water never gets near the reactor itself. There's a couple of different closed loops, but then you are constantly taking away this heat and turning it into electricity as fast as you can. And then if anything goes wrong, that can be a problem.
Amazing. Amazing. Oh, a round of applause.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code SQUARED. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
I would like to ask, we're going to land on your questions in a second, but I'm just curious, when you are explaining to the public, when you are communicating with people, what are you both trying to inspire in them? What do you want them to achieve? When that little girl asked me about the hiccup, she was very curious about herself, but knowing about hiccups, at least for all of human history, we have not really suffered for lack of that knowledge. And they did let me pass my medical school exam. So what are you trying to achieve with your books, with your writing? What do you hope people will get out of it?
I don't know. When I'm writing, I always think about, like, if I were going back in time to when I didn't know this thing, and I was frustrated by trying to understand it, what's like the kind of Cliff's Notes or the cheat sheet I would want to give myself so that I could skip all of the confusion and try to get to the end. And so it's like I'll when it finally clicks for me, I'm really excited to have a way of thinking about it that makes everything make sense. And I think about other people, I'm like, oh, if someone else, I imagine someone else frustrated by the same thing that frustrated me, and I'm like, oh, I want to show them. I've got the answer here. I mean, and maybe that's just a form of, I found a really cool thing, I've got to go tell everyone about it, which, you know, might really be what's at the heart of it, too.
But you're at the heart of that, then. You're assuming curiosity. You're saying, look, I'm sure you're interested in the world. I'm sure you want to know.
Well, if they're not, they'll walk away. It'll be pretty clear.
Yeah. No one's here tonight. So you have, then, that idea of going, okay, well, if you're interested, I will help you.
Yeah. Or if you're not, but you're, you know, willing to tolerate things and I'm not perceptive enough to pick up that you'd really like me to stop talking. Well, I don't know.
I think for me, that's one of the big challenges, is making sure you don't just preach to the converted, because they're a wonderful audience and they deserve being told more and more of these stories. But I think it's also important to try and capture those people who think, oh, I'm not interested in maths or science. And so I think that's why I do a lot of work with creative artists, because that's an interesting way in. That, as I said, maths is this kind of bridge, I think, between the two. So, for example, I've been working with a composer when we've written a piece for String Quartet, which explores mathematical proofs. People who will come along to that will perhaps be musicians who will then realize, oh, I didn't understand that there was all this maths hiding behind the music. So I think that's important for me. But I think the reason that I do this, I think it's twofold. One is to pay back that teacher at my school, because, you know, I want to give teachers today a book that they can give their kids that will inspire the next generation. Because if we don't have people wanting to do science, then, you know, all of these unknown theorems we don't know how to solve are going to remain unsolved. But I think the other audience, which is really important, is an adult audience, because science is so important to the way society is evolving that if you don't understand the science, and that's why I think, you know, in a way, my professorship is very old school in its title, public understanding, as far as it sounds very one way. It would probably be called science and society today. But actually, you need understanding to be able to engage in a political debate about what you're going to do with this science. So people need to know what a stem cell is. They need to know what machine learning is. They need to know about nanotechnology to be able to decide, well, what, or GM, to be able to know what to do with that. So I think that's why it's so important today that we have a scientifically literate society, so we can make informed decisions about the future.
I think that's a hugely important point, and it's really noticeable in both of your work that the importance of engaging the public is not of some vague, ethereal, you know, possibility that you might have an enjoyable experience. It's not merely entertainment. The person who is the best protein folder in the world, at least she was a couple of years ago. It was a housewife who lives in the Midland in England. No formal scientific training at all, but she works on a gamified version of protein folding. And humans seem to be good enough at recognizing patterns that her brain, just given the raw information of a picture of a protein, was able to discover a more stable configuration. There's huge, vast citizen science projects which are published in serious journals and contribute serious knowledge. So I think there's a huge joy and a huge pleasure in all of your work that does feel like entertainment, but at the heart of it, it seems to me that we do end up with a better world. With that in mind, I think we should get to your questions, since you are the engaged public, the most engaged public. Can we start with number one?
Hello, thank you for your insights this evening. I'm wondering, how can you teach the public about critical appraisal, is my question.
That's a lovely question. Okay, critical appraisal. Number two, where's number two?
Hi. So, thank you very much to you both. There's been a lot of research saying that scientists are perceived as warm, or rather trustworthy and competent, but not necessarily warm or coming across as the type of people that can be related to, and apparently that hinders science communication. How do you feel about conveying science? Do you think that a subject is strong enough to stand on its own, or that every scientist needs to present themselves as well as their work? Ooh. And is that something we should be considering more when communicating science?
The modest witness. I love it. And number three.
Are there things that you think we shouldn't simplify?
Lovely. Okay. Can we start? I think I'll try and go. Basically, I'm going to start with you, Randall, and then Marcus, can you kick in, and then we'll start with Marcus. That makes sense. Critical appraisal, Randall.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I know what that means.
Yeah, and I think that needs to be stuck. I agree. I think that needs to be stuck in a 10-100 sentence.
Well, and by the way, that's been my New Year's resolution since around when I did this book, which was nowhere near New Year's. But I've started, whenever anyone uses a phrase or a word that I don't know, especially when it's on a restaurant menu, I just ask what it is, and it's like incredibly freeing. So I recommend you all try this.
So can you clarify then, using the most popular 1,000 words in the English language?
Or whatever words, yeah.
So when people say things, some things are more right than others. How can you be sure that one thing is, or how can you teach the public to value that?
I don't know. I think this is sort of almost more of a tricky kind of sociology question than, or like a almost political question, because I don't think anyone thinks I don't like true things. I don't want things, to know things that are true. I think we're all just coming into stuff with a lot of very different sets of assumptions. And sometimes it's easier to phrase those in terms of, well, these people are just saying things that aren't true, and that's the problem. They just need to value truth more. But I don't know that it's necessarily that they don't value truth more. It's more maybe they're starting with ideas that are disconnected or wrong or have some other mismatch in the way they're thinking about things. But I think just telling them, it's sort of like telling people, well, just you should be smarter or you should use common sense, that it's almost that way of framing things seems like it's doomed to be unproductive.
You're nervous about measles vaccinations and climate change. Is that fair to say? Is that the kind of critical appraisal you're thinking of?
Yeah.
Yeah? What do you think, Marcus?
I think that one of the troubles with science education is that we tend to present things as finished stories, and we're almost too scared to open up the possibility that there might be another story out there. And of course, that's what we love as scientists, is always looking for the fault in a theory to be able to move it on to another stage. So my kids are doing history, for example, where they learn this kind of critical appraisal. So they understand that texts are probably biased, and they learn the skills to test the text to see what the bias might be. And I think that's one place where we need to bring that into science, to give people the tools to be able to question, when is this data actually, you see a graph, and the graph is actually misleading because they've only shown you the very top bit, and they haven't shown you the huge bit underneath. And so I think we don't really equip
people with the skills to critically analyze and question things. And that's why I think, well, you know, this kind of Gove was very clever in a way with his kind of like don't trust the experts, because I think there, you know, people just felt like, oh, I'm just being told things and I have to accept it, and haven't got the critical tools to be able to distinguish different stories when they come up.
Yeah, but this is also, it's really tricky. I don't there's a really interesting piece by a researcher, Dana Boyd, about media literacy and teaching people how to try to evaluate claims in the media, because that's, you know, a problem that everyone's sort of grappling with right now. But she sort of took an interesting tack on this, where she looked at, like, in practice, if you teach someone, you know, how to question and do their own research and look for their own sources, that it how sure are we that kind of teaching someone the scientific method necessarily helps them answer questions of their own? Because what she found were a lot of examples of people. What it meant was, when someone told them something that they didn't like, you know, vaccines are safe or whatever, they would say, well, I'm going to go and look for multiple sources and, you know, research this. And they would just go and Google and then read down until they found something that contradicted that and be like, oh, well, this person makes a really good argument. I think the experts are wrong, you know.
What about the likability and relatability of scientists? Is that important?
Well, I always enjoy doing maths because the mathematics spoke for itself, and I didn't have to, more than any other science, where, you know, science, you never know actually whether the theory is correct, and you have to kind of spend a lot of time trying to support that theory. And if you look at physics blogs, they're full of vitriol and anger and people fighting. Maths blogs are not like that, because the math speaks for itself. You don't have to, you know, once your thing's proved, it's got a validity to it. So in a way, I chose maths because I didn't want to have to put my personality into it. But I think actually, what I've learned is that it is important when you're doing science communication that we should, you know, scientists are just members of society. We're no different from, we have certain skills and other people have skills as well. So I think that is important, to show that we aren't some weird people with, you know, I've never worn a lab coat in my life. I mean, you know.
Are there things that shouldn't be made simple?
I would say that, no, I wouldn't say there are things. I think there are things which it might be impossible to make simple, which I think is a slight... So if that's true, then maybe those are things you shouldn't try and simplify, because you will always lose the essence of the story. And I had a challenge with one of these in the book What We Cannot Know, because I wanted to try and explain quantum physics. And my big problem with quantum physics was that it is... In essence, you have to use mathematics in order to be able to truly understand what it's saying. And it leads you, the mathematics leads you into these all very strange sort of conclusions. And when you try and translate it into natural language, you know, like you did, Randall, it doesn't work. It doesn't translate. And that's why people go, that's just weird. What do you mean an electron doesn't have a momentum and a position at the same time? It's in two places at the same time. I found when I was trying to explain that chapter that we do our best, but maybe that is something that if you truly want to understand quantum physics, as much as we all try in writing popular science books about it, the only way to truly know what's going on is to stay in this complicated language of mathematics.
When I was thinking about what complicated things to illustrate in my book, one of the ones I was thinking, what things are there that have a lot of parts inside? We don't really know how that people don't, you know, I don't understand how they work, or I think would be really interesting to show. And one of the first things that came up was like an old mechanical watch, you know, the kind that I used to have a little timer that I had gotten from my grandfather that, you know, you could pop open the face and see a whole bunch of gears, and so I thought that would be a really fun thing to illustrate. But what I found really quickly, before I even got to the point of, like, you know, talking to a watchmaker, I mean, just like reading, you know, like going down the list of all the parts, is that every part was like shaped in a certain way, and it was shaped in a certain way to make the nearby parts, you know, turn at the right speed or in the right direction or whatever. But that if you put 50 of them together, it made a watch. But there wasn't... The mapping that to words wouldn't necessarily produce something that was easier to understand than a watch. it worked because all the parts are shaped that way. If you shape them differently, it wouldn't work. But the parts are shaped like that because that's the shape that works for what you want, you know. And it's a lot like the clicking pen thing. Like the mechanism is sort of odd, three-dimensional. It's kind of hard to draw even. It's not that complicated. Like, if you look at it, you can understand it. But there aren't necessarily words that make it clearer. It's like, well, it's the thing that moves like this.
I'll try and direct the microphones. Question number one. Question number two, you've got one there. Okay, question number one.
Thanks to all of you for your input this evening. Randall, you were talking earlier about simplifying things, and every now and again, I go to XKCD and just can't understand it. And there's a lot of in-jokes. There's a lot of sci-fi references I don't get. So one of the things that's great is there's a wiki site called Explain XKCD, which runs in parallel, which is fantastic. Why don't you give us the answers on your site? Why does the community need to pitch in to give the real world view?
Lovely. Lovely.
Hi. So I'm also a physicist over here, and I couldn't help but notice when you described your scientific peers, you used the word he, and that's something that I've obviously become aware of, being a woman in science. And I guess my question is, why do you think, even though girls perform as well as boys at the age of 16 at school in science, they then rapidly drop out? Why and what else can we do to do better?
Lovely. And question number four.
Randall, I tend to find XKCD wonderfully nerdy, although at times there's been some that have found a lot of resonance outside, including the one you made on climate change and the one on radiation after Fukushima. Are you ever tempted to take up public education or kind of illustrate things that are going on more full-time?
Just to say that I try to wait until I feel like I have something useful to say that's not being said by someone else, you know, or that I figured out, here's a way to explain this that I think is better than the explanation that I've seen, or I'm just really excited to share. And if I don't have that, I mean, I don't know, I don't think I'm sort of hesitant to try to inject myself into everything. For explanations, I don't know, I think it's like people sometimes will assume from reading my comics, because I'll do a comic about this weird topic and that topic and that topic, and it's like, he must know about everything. And really, it's just like, those are the things that I happen to have read about that day, and that no one will ever have a complete overlap, with the things someone else knows. Like, there are always things you know that any other person doesn't know, and vice versa. I don't know, it feels a little bit self-centered to try to be like, and by the way, here's a complete index to all the things that I've been thinking about lately and talking about. You know, I feel like that could never end if I started doing that. So it's nice that I guess people are putting that together.
So now women in science, and I notice with the questions, I thought I'd be able to point at people, but it's quite difficult to do. Can the questioners aim for a few women as well? Because so far you were the first female questioner, I believe. Can you speak to women in science and why they drop out?
Well, I don't think they are dropping out. My experience is that more and more we're getting an equality in the departments that and mathematics is probably the subject which has suffered most on this. For example, first Fields Medal to go to a woman, just very, very recent. And I think that one of the things is having very good role models, and we're getting more and more good role models. So if you come to the department in Oxford, we have, as soon as you enter at the moment, we've got massive great posters of all the women that do mathematics in our department, what they do. So we're celebrating very much what they do, trying to create good role models. It's when I did the story of maths, it was an issue, because when we went back through history, it was so male-dominated, and that is a problem, because I seem to be just telling stories of men doing science. So I do try and find, at the moment I'm doing a project where we're doing these tessellating Chladni plates where we vibrate these plates with sand on and create these amazing effects. And we use it to tell the story of Sophie Germain, who was the person who first answered, well, how on earth do you explain the extraordinary patterns that are going on these plates? So I think that really just helps to kind of normalize that, yeah, of course, it's... not really an issue. And that seems to, I think, is the way forward.
And do you feel like your comics reach a very wide audience, but there is within the web-based scientific community, the Wikipedia editors, there is massive gender bias, even among things that should be very accessible. Do you feel like you have to reach, do you work to reach a different audience or a broader audience or... that you look for? I don't know. I didn't read the thing explainer with kind of gender in mind, but did you write it with gender in mind?
I think that I do. I do my best. I'm sorry, by the way, if I said he. That is something that I try to be conscious of and avoid.
It might have been me.
You know. Well, but what I
also
although I will say when I was talking about peers kind of aggressively interrupting to say, well, actually, so and so, I'm talking about men there. I tried to be conscious. I had a number of conversations with my editors on the human body chapter where I lobbied for how to discuss that. In a way that sort of separates the biology from the kind of social element, it's just a few labels. But I tried to do the wording carefully there. But for this kind of broadly women in science, one thing that the one place where that sort of touches on what I talked about is I've had women talk about that insecurity, when you come into a conversation with this insecurity in a sense, oh, these people know things and I'm not sure if I know things. And if you're a man, you just it's a lot easier to say, okay, well, I feel entitled and I should know these things, and so I'm going to barge ahead. And then women have a very different, societal pressure saying, constantly pushing them to defend, to say, well, maybe they've, people have written about feeling like if I don't understand something, maybe it's because I don't belong here, maybe it's because I'm different in some way, and that kind of imposter syndrome is something that's really tough if you're a woman or coming from any kind of a group where you already feel like you don't belong. But then beyond that, I don't know. I think that. To some extent, I'm limited. I do my best, but I'm limited in how much I can contribute to this. And so I try to, when I'm talking to people, when I'm referring to other experts, to the extent that I do that, to just to point to women who have interesting things to say and amplify what they're saying.
What's number one?
What role, if any, have you found that humor plays in being able to explain things and make them more accessible to people?
Fantastic. Poetry, humor. I can't see number three. Number four. Who's got number four?
Let's say you're in a room with a five-year-old. How would you interest them in science?
Lovely. And number three? Where is number three?
Do you think there's a danger in explaining things as simply using the 1,000 words that you may come off as sort of pedantic, sort of like looking down on those you speak to? Do you view there's a danger in offending those you're trying to teach? Because sometimes if you talk to children like in a childish way, they may say, don't talk to me like that, you're making me sound like I'm a stupid idiot or something like that.
That's a lovely question. I mean, no. Humour is your within your wheelhouse. What led you there, and what does it do for you?
Well, I like reading funny things. I don't really know why, but I do think that there's something to be said for, they say that for any kind of talk, starting with a joke is really helpful, and I think it's partly helpful because a joke really makes it clear that you and the listener are kind of on the same page about something in a way that that other stuff, that other, you know, descriptions, that other ways of communicating might not. So it's like if you make a joke at the expense of something, someone who's like, I wasn't sure if we were laughing at that or if it was, you know, solemn or if it was, it's like, oh, okay, this is fine, we can relax, you know, and I think there's, and then of course if there's a joke, it makes people, once they've understood it, more likely to want to share it with other people. And so in that way, making things funny can really help sort of make them spread on their own.
I do lots of children's television, and I think you're also giving permission to find things enjoyable. That the humour is about pure pleasure, and then you can introduce. If we put in our fart jokes in our kids' show, we can do some very complex science, which gets us to And I'm sort of serious about that. It's strange actually. Which gets us to the next couple of questions about language, about being patronising, about how would you engage a 5-year-old? You must, and I know that you have. You know, the audience is quite has a big age range here. How would you engage a 5-year-old?
Well, it's interesting. I think we have quite contrasting styles of delivering our science to the public. And Randall's is very visual, but I love storytelling. So a lot of mine is about telling a story. And what I think my teacher did when he took me aside with the maths was to show me some really big stories. And so for me, I think that we very often don't. We in maths especially, we tell all this technical stuff, and we kind of think, oh no, but infinity is far too complicated an idea for a kid to understand. So you only get that in a third year of your undergraduate course. So my thing is to really just say, no, there's nothing kind of intrinsically technical about infinity. And actually, a 5-year-old, of course, is immediately
wondering. You're obsessed with infinity.
What's the biggest number? It's a question that every kid, or is the universe, does it just go on forever? And I think that to feed those things with stories is what I would do. I mean, infinity, I think, is a terrific place to start, actually, for a 5-year-old.
Because my son's just obsessed with counting. Yeah. He just wants to see how high he can get, and it does keep him busy.
Yeah, so this So my favourite maths joke is, so the teacher asks the class, so what's the biggest number? And a kid goes, 5,623. And she goes, well, what about 5,624? And the kid goes, oh, I was so close.
That's it. You get nervous when someone says my favourite maths joke. You're like, oh, is this where he's going to really die?
I always use that. You know, if nobody laughs, I realise I've really lost the audience.
Lost the crowd.
But I would say, just in general, understand that my advice is, and this is something that I've tried to take to heart, is people, no matter their educational level, no matter, you know, where they're coming from, everyone can sort of smell condescension. And they know when you're talking down to them. And so honestly, try not to do that, you know? And so, like, with these words, I'm... When I pick this gimmick, it's sort of almost, you know, I'm not writing this, you know, some people say that it's helpful for kids or people new to the language, and that's really cool, but who I'm writing this for is people my own age who I'm like, I'm playing this game, I'm going to try to explain this in this, you know, in this kind of ridiculous way. I'm not saying I don't think you already know it. I'm saying this is how I would put it in these terms, and maybe you'll be entertained by it, or maybe it will explain it to you. I don't know. But I try not to... I do think that being able to gauge how you're going to come across to someone is... I mean, I think it's one of the hardest problems that people tackle. It's how to relate to other people. I think that's just about the hardest thing humans do. So my advice is just if you really are being, you know, feeling condescending towards someone, they'll be able to tell. And so try to be nicer.
That's a lovely answer. I think you capture very beautifully there the sincerity of motive. And I must say, both of you are enormous heroes of mine. The projects that you both undertake have a wonderful generosity. A lot of science is about holding knowledge in and not sharing it and either making money or trying to win a prize or publish before someone else. And a lot of life in general is about showing that you're better than somebody else. And both of you have a humble, generous approach, which I think avoids condescension and is extraordinary. It's been enormous fun for me sitting on stage with the pair of you. I'm sure that everyone else has had equally as much fun as I have. Please thank both our speakers very much. I hate to interrupt the applause because it's so well deserved. Thank you, Intelligence Squared. Thank you all.